Welcome to Animal Voices. Tom Reagan wrote, he said, in the long run, it's the power of ideas that will make the most profound and lasting contribution to the course of justice for animals. We degrade other life. We destroy a kinship with the living world. We alienate ourselves from all of nature, all to keep up some old habits and appetites. And Henry David Thoreau, he wrote, I have no doubt that it is part of the destiny of the human race in its gradual improvement to leave off eating animals. You're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And our webpage is animalvoices.org. Many of our programs are listed on that webpage, animalvoices.org. Alan Jensen, thank you for being our technician. My name is Carl Oskin, and in the studio today, we have Marge Adams. And Marge, what will you be doing today?
Well, I have a delightful guest named Joanne Chang, who is going to be calling in. And Joanne, as many of our listeners know, is from Liberation BC and a real animal activist. Well, Joanne has been a full month in Asia, and she's going to tell us something about her experiences over there.
Right. Within a few minutes, we'll be speaking with Dean Wyatt, who lives in Knight Inlet, and he will present us with a viable alternative to the hunting of grizzlies in British Columbia. Yes, they are hunting grizzlies in British Columbia. So, Alan, we just covered a few items that were of interest in the media in the last week. They recently discovered an albino crow in Vancouver. And this is, of course, a time quite critical for young fledgling birds when they're leaving the animals. And, well, first of all, what do you think about the albino crows?
Well, not only that, but on Vancouver Island, a pair of albino ravens were found last week, too. So there's two cases of albino corvids, that is, crows, ravens, being found in the last couple of weeks around this area, which is quite an unusual coincidence, an unusual thing. some species of birds are more liable to have albinos than other species, like robins. Often you'll see a robin that has a bit of white in the wing or somewhere, they're partial albino. Nonetheless, this is a quite extraordinary thing to see and to have happen.
Now, there was a number of people who were totally intrigued by these birds. Now, when these birds take their first flight and they land on ground, that's probably the most extreme, dangerous point for them. And what should humans be doing at that time?
Just staying away from them as much as possible. Don't interfere with them. You might think that they've been abandoned or that they've fallen out of the nest or something, but almost always there's an adult bird around that is actually got an eye on the small bird and will bring it food and so on. And you really can't tell. And often when the birds are first learning to fly, they don't fly very well, and they can fly a little bit, and then they land on the ground or on a branch or something, and they're uncertain about their next little flight, and so they're just sitting there, and you'll see them sitting there, and you'll think that it's abandoned or injured or something, but it's not. It's just learning to fly, and like I said, there's an adult bird always around somewhere keeping an eye on the young ones.
Thank you, Alan, for your insight. Marge, there's a full-page advert in the Georgia Strait this week, and it's from the Vancouver Humane Society. So maybe you can just give us some of the items that are on there.
Yes, rather interesting. There's a diagram showing the devastating effects of meat on the human body, and it tells where the meat comes from. When one is a meat eater, what you could suffer as a result.
What could you suffer?
Let me just read the ad to you. There's a lot of reasons to cut back on the amount of meat you consume. Billions of animals are suffering at factory farms. The livestock industry is contributing significantly to climate change and polluting our air and water. And the overconsumption of meat is making us fat and unhealthy. But even two meatless days a week is enough to make a difference. And for this reason, go to the website for further information, www.vancouverhumanesociety.bc.ca. Now, the diagram shows heart disease as one example of what can happen to you. Colon cancer, meat hangs around a long time in the digestive system and decays there and can cause various problems. Pollution in the environment, which is dangerous to humans, of course, and global warming. Also, we need to be concerned about diabetes. E. coli, we know how devastating that can be. We've heard that many times. The animal cruelty, of course, is a big issue.
You know, John Robbins, who wrote the book Diet for a New America and The Food Revolution, wonderful books, and he wrote, as he said, a reduction in meat consumption is probably the most potent single act individuals can take in the effort to halt the destruction of the environment and preserve our precious resources. Reducing meat consumption conserves water, saves energy, preserves topsoil, and reduces our dependence on chemical pesticides and fertilizers, and protects forests, while improving our health. That's from John Robbins, and they have an organization right here in Vancouver, a wonderful organization called Earth Save Canada. Their webpage is earthsave.ca, and I am an active member. Well, we do have Dean Wyatt. Dean Wyatt lives in Knight Inlet, and he will present us today with a wonderful and viable alternative to hunting grizzlies in British Columbia. Welcome to Animal Voices, Dean.
Good morning. Good afternoon, I guess it is.
Yes, and well, you live in that wonderful part of the world up there, and also you're involved in also teaching people about what the grizzly hunt is doing it. And of course, there's been much in the press about opposition to this. Maybe you can give us your insight from Knight Inlet.
Well, I can tell you that from our perspective, we don't believe in the hunt. We don't believe that it's from the population basis, that it's not biologically responsible, as well as ethically, it has no standing in today's world. The need to hunt the bear just for your own ego is totally beyond comprehension as far as I'm concerned. We don't believe that biologically the hunt is sustainable, even though the government will argue. So that's kind of the crux of our reason that we've done what we've done and presented a more than viable answer to economic vitality for the province instead of hunting to come bear viewing.
So what do? You come bear viewing, and maybe you can just give us an idea of your setup.
Well, basically we're a floating lodge that's located halfway up Knight Inlet. It's a beautiful fjord, a classic Norwegian fjord halfway up the central coast. We're on the southern edge of the Great Bear Rainforest. Knight Inlet makes up the southern edge of it. And it's a classic Norwegian fjord. It's 98 miles long, 2 miles wide, about 1,200 feet deep. Mountains up to 7,000 feet right out of the water, glaciers, waterfalls. It's spectacular. And we have a large concentration of grizzly bears in our particular area because of a man-made attractant that was put in by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans to bring back a dead river. The river was basically silted over and ruined by the loggers back in the 70s and 80s, and the DFO and their wisdom, and it was their wisdom, for all the stuff we hear bad about them, this is one of the great things that they've done. They built a spawning channel there, and it has been wildly successful and brought about the total rejuvenation of our whole ecosystem there, and in doing that brought us a great population of grizzly bears that's growing at a steady basis.
So how is the grizzly bear population doing, as opposed to the black bear?
Well, I mean, black bear, there's a lot more black bears than there are grizzly bears, and I think you're going to find in the province, you know, you'll hear all these constant people saying, oh, you know, we have to hunt the bear because the population's good. The problem is that grizzly bears are pockets. They live in pockets. They're historically, everyone's heard that they're this wide-ranging animal, and they cover this vast territory, and they do that in the Rockies and in the interior. But on the coast, they're very centralized because their protein source is all, of course, in the rivers and streams where the fish are. And that's their prime source of food from the summer and fall. So the populations get very, very concentrated. And, you know, and to give you an example, last year, our busiest day ever, we had 27 grizzly bears at the same time within 100 yards of our viewing platforms.
Wow. Now the government, maybe give us some information here. The government lifted the present provincial government lifted the moratorium on the grizzlies. So people are hunting grizzlies. I mean, it's outrageous, but maybe let's hear it in your words.
Well, I mean, people have hunted grizzly bears in the province of British Columbia forever. As long as the white man has come here, and even the Aboriginals before us, they hunted the grizzly bear for ceremonial purposes. When the white people arrived, we hunted them for trophies. They've never been a meat source. They're strictly a trophy hunt. And so forever, the province has condoned it. In fact, the Ministry of the Environment, a bit of a misnomer in my mind, but it was created to manage fish and wildlife so that man wouldn't erase them from the face of the planet. So basically, for the last 100 years, that ministry, or plus years, that ministry has tried to administer the trophy hunt for all the species in the province as well as fishing. And there was a brief period before the NDP were about to be defeated in the last election. There was 6 months where there was a moratorium in place. But don't ever let the NDP fool you. The hunt was on full blast when they were in power as well. It was just a political move at the end, and it was too bad because it became all embroiled in politics, which it was never meant to do. It wasn't about the animals. It was about politics.
Now, there's also the politics of numbers of how many there are. And do you agree with what the department is saying?
Well, I totally disagree with the population density models that they use. I don't believe that the government has effectively proved their theory, but it's this is scientist arguing with scientists, and I mean the government scientists will tell you they're dead on. Independent scientists will tell you that they don't know what they're talking about. What I do find very, very interesting is British Columbia is probably the only jurisdiction in the world that uses this type of model to determine population density for grizzly bears, and they haven't proven the model. I mean, there is no question that in one or two pockets in British Columbia, they have proven that their density models look right. But there's also been seven or eight that they've tried to prove that it doesn't work. And at the end of the day, the grizzly bear is a very, very, very hard animal to get up any kind of a population estimate on. And in the end, we aren't working on the precautionary principle. We just believe that they can hunt. And at the end of it all, the government has always believed that, you know, it's a sustainable hunt. And their job is to make sure that people can keep hunting. So that's what they do.
Now, in a recently released poll, it said that 73% of British Columbians support the end to the trophy hunting of grizzlies. So so in spite of that overwhelming public sentiment, they continue it. Is it for what reason? Do they... You're presenting an alternative. Don't they understand that viewing these animals is just as good?
Well, I think that the problem that you have, and I can tell you that it's an issue again that comes down to bureaucracy in the government. I mean, the ministries that are in place to manage wildlife are there to manage wildlife to give sustainable hunts and keep manageable populations that can be hunted. And in the end, they don't want to know about a viable alternative because how do you get rid of a hunt? So, you know, because what you end up with is you end up with this old urban rural myth that the people in the country, they want to hunt and it's only the urban people that are against the hunt. Well, in reality, if you look at these polls, those poll numbers are across the province, urban and rural. It is not strictly a high urban concentration that's determined that these people don't want to hunt. But the government is under such pressure from lobby groups like the Guide Outfitters Association of British Columbia, the BC Wildlife Federation, that you can't take away our rights to hunt. And what do you do when you have a ministry that has, you know, well over 600 people working for it, and their whole job is to manage hunts and manage fisheries and that? It's not about conserving wildlife, it's about harvesting wildlife. And so they'd be going against themselves. And we've argued with the ministry saying, why won't you accept wildlife viewing as an alternative? And no, they'd rather spend millions trying to get younger kids to hunt and get people back in there so they can get people to hunt. And I don't know why. It defies logic to me, but it's just a government thing.
Thank you for saying that, Dean. Dean, you know, the point of interest was that this is a trophy hunt. I mean, that's what people do when they shoot grizzlies. But they never used that. Even the First Nations, you mentioned this morning, that they never, it was, the food was never, it was never consumed as food.
Grizzly bear, I mean, black bear is an edible bear product. Grizzly bears have a very high parasite count. And I think that if anyone does any research, what they'll find is that the grizzly, even from the First Nations perspective, was not a food source. It was strictly a ceremonial animal. It was an apex predator in the woods. Any people who've eaten grizzly bear invariably end up with a parasite infestation in their body. And I frankly have never heard of anyone that's eaten grizzly bear successfully and not got parasites. And I've never heard of anyone in recent years who actually eats grizzly bear, and I honestly believe that there's no one out there who does. It's strictly, absolutely strictly about trophy. The apex predator man wanting to hunt the apex predator grizzly bear, and the winner being the man, of course, who stands there 1,000 feet away with his gun with a big scope on it and shoots.
Now you have this, presumably you have a boat, and you earlier on you mentioned that you have a platform where you have a viewing area, and you have some 2,500 people you take out there every year, way up there in, what's the nearest town, Dean?
Campbell River. Everyone has to fly into our lodge from Campbell River. There's no road access. It's a true wilderness location, and we had 2,532 people come from 19 different countries. In the last 8 years, we've had over 14,000 people come to the lodge, and I think it's about 27 different countries that they've been from, and we've had them from South Africa, from Argentina, from Brazil, from the UAE, from Saudi Arabia, India, Pakistan, you name it, all of the northern European countries, Russia, everywhere. People just come. There's a fascination with the grizzly bear.
Now you have, and you also mentioned that there were very few Canadians that came up to Knight Inlet to view, mostly foreigners. But you have a very special method to view these bears, grizzly bears, without disturbing them.
Well, we took great pains when we started this business to invest a lot of time and money with world-renowned scientists to determine a way to view the bears that was going to have the minimal impact upon them, so that we could enjoy the magnificence of them and would have the least impact upon their lives. And so we worked very hard to determine how many people will the grizzly bears support before they start to move off their food sources. And the investment in that has paid off for us time and time again, because the bears have become very comfortable. We have very strict rules with regards to food and drink and perfume and smoking. All of these things are not allowed. And the bears have been brilliant. They've tolerated us because we've tried to be as respectful as we can of their environment and allowed them to have the freedom of movement without creating obstacles that would force them to move off any kind of traditional paths or trails that they would have.
Now, you said that if you had the unlimited resource or resources to do it, you would have a refuge for grizzly bears. And, of course, there is one on Grass Mountain, so maybe just give us an overview of what is needed here.
Well, I think that the problem we face if you look at the government statistics, and I know they don't like to talk very much about these, but the government every year probably, I think over the last 5 years on average, has killed about 70 grizzly bears that they've determined to be problem bears. invariably they become problem bears because there's been an encounter with a human, that a human has done something pretty stupid, and the bear's paid the price for it because the bear's done what they do naturally, and the human has paid a pretty severe price for it. If I had my dream of dreams, it would be to have a place where those kind of bears could be rescued, removed from an environment that's potentially harmful, and put in a place that, until we found a location for them, to rehabilitate them into the wild, removed from where they were probably, or if they're young cubs, until they've gotten old enough to be able to put back into the environment so that they would be safe. And I think it would be a great thing. I know there's a little bit of black bear work that goes on and the odd grizzly bear, but traditionally it's one of those things that they just, if you shoot them, then they aren't a problem for anybody anymore. So I would love to do something to help them.
Great, great. Now, it's grizzlytours.com is your web page, but you must have had many experiences of a close encounter. Maybe they were friendly. Have you got any curious stories that explains the magic of these animals?
Well, I think that for me, I mean, if you go back to when we first started this, I was in the travel business for a number of years, and I'm a salesman. I'm very proud to say that I was a salesman in all my future lives. And when we decided to buy this lodge, my family and myself, that we were thinking that we wanted to have sports fishing as well as bears. But I didn't have a close affinity with the bears until we were working down at our spawning channel, and the DFO would ask me to perform a task for them in putting, they're called stop logs, but they're like a water flow inhibitor that you put across the river. And I was down in the river in my hip waders, and I'm putting these aluminum stop logs in, and I look, the fellow who's there with me, he starts waving wildly at me, and I look up at him, and he points behind me, and I look, and there's a mid young grizzly bear, probably 4 or 5 years old, about 300 to 400 pounds, standing about 6 feet behind me, looking at me at eye level. And you know, and I've because we've been working on this grizzly bear thing, everyone said don't look them in the eyes and don't do all these things, but it was so fascinating to look back and see this bear just looking inquisitively at me so close, and nothing threatening at all coming off him. There was no bad vibe, and I'm sitting there going, okay, now what do I do? I mean, here I am, I'm this close, I am never going to make it across the 50 feet of water to get away from him, so what do I do? And I thought, well, you know what, I'm just going to keep on working. So I turned around and continued to do my task, and my task, I had to move about every 3 or 4 minutes, I would move about another 5 or 6 feet down across the stream. And lo and behold, that bear, every time I moved, he would step down into the water and move and maintain the same distance. So we worked all the way across the river, and we got to the far side where the fellow who's standing there with the bear spray and that standing there, and he's going, should I give him bear spray? And I said, no, he's been fine. And I turn around and I look, and he stood up right there, and I'm just over six feet tall, and the bear was taller than I was, and he stood up and he looked at me right in the eye, and I looked him, I couldn't help but look him back. And it was right at that moment I realized that, you know, boy, there's something really going on in that guy's head looking at me like, what are you doing here? This is not where you're supposed to be. You're supposed to be over there. This is my territory. But why are you here? And it was just one of those moments that in your life you just kind of go like, whoa, I got to do something to help these guys. We went from a sport fishing lodge. Within 2 years, we haven't sport fished in 8 years. Now all we do is grizzly bears.
Alan Jensen has a question.
Yeah. Hi. That was a great story, it shows that, like you were saying, you can communicate with bears. You were saying there's a lot of bears come around to where your lodge is. Is that like during salmon season when the salmon are spawning or coming back down the stream?
Well, our peak of the bears is always when the salmon come back in August. But we start bear viewing in May, in the middle of May, because we have a very, very, because our river is so has been so successfully rehabilitated, we have a huge biomass that is washed into our estuary, which has created a luxuriant spring growth in the sedges and then the rice root and all of the plants and animals that the bears would traditionally feed on in the spring. So So we're very fortunate that we have a population that varies between 10 and 15 bears all through the spring and summer, and in August it starts to build, and by the time we get to September, we're up to about 50 grizzly bears.
That's amazing. With the area you're in, is this what is the designation like? What's the legal status of this area? Is it? It's not a park, right?
Oh no, no, we have no protection at all. In fact, one of the it's crown. We have a license of occupation on crown land. I own a lot of private property there, but I also have a license of occupation and a lease to operate and run a bear viewing operation on crown land, which is where the river is located and is abuts onto a First Nations reserve. It's just crown land, and in fact, the reason we've been reasonably successful, and I don't know if you remember, but in 1999, the guide outfitter came right in front of our clients and tried to drive the bears out of this. We have a little no hunting zone. It's about 17 square kilometers, and the guide outfitters tried to get the bears to move out of the no hunting zone so that they could shoot one. They were there with a client from Colorado, and we called the CTV, and they came up and they filmed the whole thing going on and embarrassed the guide outfitter immensely, created a little bit of harassment for myself and my family for a year or so, and the old death threat thing and all that stuff that goes on with it. But anyway, what we do now is that we actually, for the last 2 years, we have bought the hunt from the guide outfitter. My clients buy these wristbands that we sell at the lodge, and we pay the guide outfitter over $25,000 a year not to hunt.
Wow. Well,
we just had somebody call in, a listener, and mentioned that he'd heard that there's a large run-of-the-river power project going in at Knight Inlet. Do you know about this?
There's a potential of a run-of-the-river power project up in the Cleany, which is 40 miles away from us. It's up at the head of the inlet.
So it wouldn't affect your organization?
No, it won't affect our business at all. It'll be interesting to see if it does get the go-ahead or not. There's some issues up there with protected land and that it's still a long ways from being approved. Believe it or not, where it would be going is probably going to have minimal impact on a lot of the species up there, because it's not in the prime food areas for them.
Thank you, Dean. It's been so fascinating hearing from you. GrizzlyTours.com. People can have a look at that, GrizzlyTours.com. And for also showing us that there is a viable alternative to hunting of the grizzlies here in BC, and that these magnificent animals are elusive and highly intelligent, and you're promoting their well-being. So thank you for being on Animal Voices.
Thank you very, very much for having me on.
Thank you, Dean.
All right, then.
And we have you listening to Animal Voices, coming to you on CFR Radio 102.7 FM. Many of our programs are posted on our webpage, animalvoices.org. And, yes, we have our next caller on the line, and over to you, Marge.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, Joanne Chang is on the line, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, she's a very active member of Liberation BC. Joanne was in Asia for a full month, and at that time she was serving with PETA Asia Pacific. Now, most of you know that PETA is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and she was working as an intern with that organization, which has an office in Hong Kong. Hello, Joanne, are you there?
Hey, Marge, how are you?
Oh, I'm well. I'm glad you're back, and I hope you had a wonderfully eventful time in Asia.
Yeah, it was actually quite eye-opening, and I learned a lot there. So
I'll bet you did. Which countries did you visit?
I visited the Philippines and Taiwan.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now, Taiwan, you lived in Taiwan, didn't you?
I grew up there, yeah, for the first part of my life, yeah.
You must have felt quite at home.
Yes, yeah.
Now, what kind of work were you doing with PETA?
I was there as their Taiwan representative, sort of. So I was doing translations into Chinese and calling up media in Taiwan to pitch events and vegetarianism to the Taiwanese media.
Aha, I see. So how successful were you in getting these events covered?
It was pretty good. There was quite a lot of interest. We one of the big projects we were working on was World Vegetarian Week. So we had various representatives, various interns from different countries. So I was representing Taiwan, and we had Australia and Japan as well. So we got our vegetarian recipes on local newspapers, and as well as a demo where we went and dressed ourselves up in lettuce and got a lot of media attention that way.
That sounds like Liberation BC to me. Tell us about your demonstration, will you?
It was in Taipei during World Vegetarian Week, and me and Ashley Fruno, the founder of Liberation BC, who now works for PETA Asia Pacific, we stapled lettuce to these bras and shorts that we had on, so it looked like a lettuce bikini, and we stood in front of this this famous building called Taipei 101, and had signs in Chinese and in English that says "Turn over a new leaf, go vegetarian."
Did you get lots of attention from the public?
We did. People kept slowing down as they were driving by to take pictures of us. And because in Taiwan, actually, vegetarianism is quite popular. So it was a message that was quite welcoming to the people.
And I suppose you were handing out recipes there, were you?
No, it was basically just done for the media. And because there in Asia, there's more of an opportunity for international pickup. And we were able to get some pickup in Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, and India, as well as Taiwan.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
Sounds great. So vegetarianism was a popular topic to be working on. How about the animal rights issue and animal welfare, that kind of thing? What sort of general impression did you get or general reactions did you get when you were working on those angles?
There's a need for it, and people are very receptive to the message. When we're out there leafletting, when we're out there with the animal rights message, people have never heard this message before in Asia, and you know the people are very open to it.
That's good to hear.
There's no resistance like here. People already know what animal rights is about, and they already have an opinion about it. Whereas over there, it's just sort of they're just like a sponge sucking up all the information we give them.
I see. Well, that's a good way to start, isn't it?
Yeah. It's great that PETA is over there because there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah. Now you talk about a lot of work. You did finish a visit to a zoo in Manila. You know, you mentioned and animal shelters. Can you tell us about the zoo for a start?
Yeah, the Manila Zoo is pretty much like zoos you would see here maybe 30 years ago. The animals are in like barren cages with concrete floor and metal bars. It's very sad, and you know, people just need to be educated about that these animals need more than just concrete floors. It was kind of heartbreaking to see there was this one monkey who was in just a barren cage, and he was reaching out of his cage because there were some greens growing right outside his cage, and he couldn't reach it. So we were taking pictures, and we decided to pick the greens and hand it to him. He grabbed the greens, and all he did was he wanted to sniff it. He just smelled it, closed his eyes, smelled it, chewed on it, and touched it to his face.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he wanted, just to be that part of nature.
It really breaks your heart, doesn't it?
It really, really does. And the animals, you can tell they were depressed. Some of the animals just sat in one position for like 15 minutes, did not move. Some of them had ulcers and stuff like that, and they weren't treated because obviously it's a poor country and there's not going to be any care going into the animals.
Yes. What type of animals did you see besides the ones you mentioned?
There's an elephant that PETA is trying to get out of the zoo. She's there by herself on concrete floors with no water. No water to play in, and she's just gawked at all day. There's an orangutan who's in a big cell, a dark cell, all by herself. She just lays there and doesn't really seem very interested in life. Apparently, she's been there for about 20 years, all by herself.
Reminds me of that hippo that was in the Greater Vancouver Zoo.
Yes.
It's pretty sad.
And they do have a hippo there, and I was quite ashamed when I went there and saw that the hippo actually had a pool to swim in, whereas in the Greater Vancouver Zoo, it took them a long time before our hippo even got any water.
And a lot of pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. And crocodiles, too, I believe you mentioned.
Yeah, there was the zoo was right on the side of the road, so you could hear behind the wall, you can hear the traffic, the city noises, and right next to all of the traffic noise is a pond for the crocodiles. There was about 21 crocodiles in a very small enclosure. Some of them were missing limbs, and the water was very, very dirty and shallow.
And now, who is operating this? Is it a private zoo, or would that be a public government operated?
I think it's government operated, and there simply is no funding for it. Well, even if there was funding, I mean, these animals are living in areas that they're not supposed to be living in. There's desert animals living in this really damp and moist tropical areas.
Not very healthy for them, certainly.
No.
You also visited a government-operated dog shelter in Taipei.
Yeah, there's a huge issue with street dogs in Taipei. This is because people like pets, and the same as anywhere else, the pet industry creates these animals that are dumped, animals that are unwanted, and what we saw was very heartbreaking. Ashley and I went into a government-run pound. Basically, they're dog catchers that go on the street and take any strays, and they hold them in these cells until for 7 days, and then they kill them. So we went into this government-run shelter unannounced and saw the condition that the animals would normally be in. We found a dog that was laying on the ground with lacerations on his legs, cannot move. He is laying in a puddle of urine, and he was just left there to die.
Awful, terrible. Now, are dogs eaten in Taiwan?
Not anymore because of recently there's been pressure. There are local activist groups that work really hard on the dog issue. And in the past, I think in the past 5 years or so, they passed legislation, so now dog eating is actually illegal in Taiwan.
Well, there's progress for you, isn't it?
Yeah. However, it's, you know, with dogs, like here, like anywhere else, it's the pet industry. People go into these pet shops and they just want to buy animals, and they don't see what happens to these animals because the dogs we saw at that horrible shelter, they were all purebreds. Someone bred them, a breeder or a pet shop, to be someone's beloved pet, and that's how they end up.
So is PETA working on all kinds of issues, or are they directed at certain issues in the present time in Asia?
They're everywhere in Asia, wherever there's a need. They're doing campaigns in Thailand about elephants. As you know, elephants are very much abused in Thailand for the tourists. They're beaten. They're forced to give people rides. So they're working on the elephant issue in Thailand.
Oh yes, and various other issues,
yeah,
depending on the country.
And right, like in Hong Kong and Japan are the more modern, high fashion cities. They're working on the fur issue, trying to get Burberry to stop selling fur. And they recently convinced Miss Universe, who is Japanese, to stop wearing fur, as well as they did some demos in Hong Kong during Fashion Week where they jumped the stage and got a lot of media attention.
Hong Kong is really their center of operation, I guess, huh?
So they do have an office in Hong Kong and in Manila as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so pet operation overpopulation is another really big problem, as it is here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's just here we don't really see it that much. Mm-hmm. However, when you do look into it, shelters are filled with dogs and cats, and they're always being euthanized. And that's because people are buying animals from pet stores, which people should not be doing. People should be going to shelters and adopting animals.
Right. And now, I imagine education is the number one effort that's being made. I'm so pleased to hear that people are receptive to the animal rights issues. Can you tell us a bit about the kind of programs they're using to educate people besides what you were doing?
PETA basically is just they're very good with the media, so they're very good at getting media attention.
Yes.
I think that's basically the way they're educating people. Mm-hmm. For instance, whenever there's an opportunity to talk about the vegetarian issue, such as in the Philippines where there's a food crisis, they wrote a letter to the president and urged her to go vegetarian.
Oh yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. And that she responded to the letter, and that got front page everywhere. So after that, you know, people are very interested in this vegetarianism and food crisis issue, and people are making the connections and starting to talk about it.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Ashley is working on these issues in one country herself, is she? Or does she have
interns? She takes care of multiple countries.
Oh, she does. Yeah.
Yeah. So the entire Asia Pacific.
Yeah, Ashley Frumo is a well-known person in this area. She's the girl with all the courage to get rid of that rodeo, wasn't she?
She was, definitely. And she's doing great work in Asia. Mm-hmm. She's quite well-known in Asia as well.
Must take a bit of extra courage, though, when you're out of your own country to do these kind of dramatic efforts.
Yeah, well, when you see the animal suffering, which in Asia you do get to see a lot of it, not because there's more of it, mm-hmm. but because things are less hidden, they're more accessible to public view.
Yes, there's a good point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, people
who are doing unpleasant things to animals aren't as ashamed, I guess, as they are in this country because of all the information that we have.
Yeah, or they're less sophisticated and protected mm-hmm. by big industries that are able to build up walls and, you know, get into universities and have big titles and torture animals that way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and we're just more sophisticated in the way we torture animals and hide it. Over there, it's just done in plain view.
Yeah. So what are the main impressions that you have after that month-long visit of Asia?
I think it's very important to do outreach in Asia or to Asian communities just because there's such a huge population. The world's biggest businesses have gone over to Asia, like KFC, McDonald's. All the big industries have gone over there for a reason, because there's so many people there. There's so many consumers there. And with all of that, with all the message from the big corporations, the other side is missing. The story about the animals, mm-hmm. the activism is missing there. So that's why it's so important to be doing outreach in Asia or even to Asian communities where this information is new. And much needed.
Yes, and now Carl has a question.
Now,
for you.
With the rise of the Southeast Asia as an economic power, mm-hmm. that means that the people are eating more meat as well.
Yes.
And so that's one aspect there that shows how important your education program is.
Exactly. Exactly. There's just so many people there. Even if you change, if you turn 1% of the population vegetarian, you'll be doing way more than anything you would be doing here, just because the people are, there's just so many more people.
Very interesting comments, Joanne. Thank you so much for taking time to do this. Now, I know you're no doubt right back in the fray of things here by this time. Mm-hmm. You want to be at home a few days. But tell us, are there particular things about Liberation BC that might need a little airing?
We're currently still working hard on our foie gras campaign, which has been going on for 3 months now. 13 establishments in Vancouver have dropped foie gras because of our campaign, and we're still encouraging people, all your listeners out there, anybody, to go onto our website, liberationbc.com, and look at the list of restaurants that are still currently serving foie gras, and giving them a call and sending them an email, because of public pressure like this, we've been able to get 13 establishments to stop serving. So it's really important for people to keep calling in.
That's wonderful, Joanne. Thank You're you welcome. So much for all the work you do.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You're very welcome.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio, 102.7 FM. And this morning I was listening to Business News Network, and I noticed the comment came over in today's report that Winnebago's sales were down by all of 40% compared to last year. And so we have Dana Lyons now singing RV. Let's celebrate RV.
Across the USA, taking in the land, wider than a Cadillac, longer than a van. Capacity 16 children, 4 tubes of old toothpaste, 3 tanks for the gasoline, 2 tanks for the waste, RV. RV. Mom and Dad in the front seat, country on the radio, Tim and Jim at the table, rock on the stereo, Sue and Lou in the back room, trumpet and clarinet, Sissy's still in the bathroom, Junior's pants are wet, RV. RV. The modern cowhands riding velvet saddles, on horses made of fiberglass they fly, air-conditioned covered wagons cross the prairie, the pioneering spirit never dies, RV. RV. Tenters watch with wonder, the bikers are afraid, the rangers take their aspirin, the animals run away, the truckers see a roadblock, the wagons see a wall, the compact see a mountain, the horses see a stall, RV. RV. From Jersey to Miami without stopping, from Texas to Alaska in one day, the stories of these heroes are astounding, the tickets and the tolls they had to pay, RV. RV. So if you're out there cruising on a U.S. interstate and you see that great white wonder, please make no mistake. On the road there is no justice, might always makes right. The suburban yacht is the king of the road, so you better get that right, RV. RV.
Yeah! Get it on there! Get it on there!
Yes, thank you, Alan. And last week, Marge, you spoke about the beavers, Canada's national symbol, animal symbol, being reintroduced in the UK. And this week we're on another story that hit the newspapers, the Vancouver Sun, mm-hmm. about the beavers being under siege in Surrey.
Right, and I have that with me, so that let me read it. Surrey has killed the beaver as its official logo, but that hasn't stopped the trench warfare in the ditches, streams, and ponds of the fast-growing community. The city killed 40 beavers through trapping this past winter, including 14 on low-lying farmland, 24 alongside industrial properties on the Fraser River, and 2 near residential communities in the Cougar Creek system. There's a lot of beavers in Surrey and a lot that we're cohabiting with, so to speak. Carrie Barron, manager of drainage and environment for Surrey, said in an interview Friday. Barron said the trapping is a last resort in critical flood risk situations where measures such as ripping apart dams have no effect. A lot of beavers we have no problem with, but in certain areas, when it becomes an extreme case, we try everything, and when people's homes are going to flood, then we have to do something. The 40 beavers killed compares with just 6 killed in Surrey over the previous winter and an annual average of 15. So that's a big difference, 40 compared to 15 average. Trappers killed 3,878 beavers BC-wide in 2005, almost 4,000 beavers in 2005, the most recent year for which government statistics are available. Surrey has little option but to kill problem beavers due to a Ministry of Environment policy prohibiting their live relocation, Barron said. There are so many beavers province-wide. Surrey communications official Joel Giebelhaus noted the traditional beaver lost out to a new logo, a stylized image of cityscape fronted by parkland unveiled just last month. The beaver has been bumped out of our logo, he confirmed, adding it remains part of the city's official coat of arms. The new logo comes from the slogan, the future lives here, sorry. But beaver may not be ready to be relegated to the past just yet, at least not without a public outcry.
Mm-hmm. So what we do have alternatives here to, and of course there was another article with Rosalind Cassells, who used to be the host here on Animal Voices, and she said, well, there are other places where they can transfer them to rather than killing these wonderful animals, which is our national symbol. So they are indeed beleaguered beavers, and I think the people of Vancouver should stand up and make sure that these animals don't get killed and tortured, and that mm-hmm. we do it in a humane way, and we'll follow Rosalind Cassell's advice.
Yeah.
And a related story I just thought I would throw in here is I just saw yesterday that in the Okanagan Valley, the wine growers, wine has become a big thing in the Okanagan Valley, the grape growers are having trouble with marmots eating their grapes. And so they're asking for permission now to start shooting the marmots. Of course, marmots have always been there. This is marmot country. And they're saying the marmots are increasing in numbers and so on. Nonetheless, the problem is, of course, that they're growing more and more grapes all the time, which the marmots, you know, nice juicy grapes there, they like to eat them. This is a sad state of affairs when these wineries are promoting themselves, as this great BC product that's grown without pesticides and all that sort of stuff. Nonetheless, are going to be eliminating the marmots from their area. A similar sort of story.
I'm sorry, but I figured I was a bit inattentive. Is it now legal to destroy a marmot? I thought it was protected.
No. No, that's the problem. And so they're asking for permission to, they're allowed to relocate them, but they're having difficulty in doing that. So they want permission now to shoot them.
I see, but they haven't got it yet. You know, you have to work on that one.
Now, we have also from the earthsave.ca webpage, they have a series of stories there that's called Transition Stories. And it's EarthSave members discuss their transition towards a plant-based diet. Well, I'm going to read one of the many stories here, and on earthsave.ca. And this one is from Dale Littlejohn. He said, one morning in 1990, I was eating breakfast, and it was bacon and eggs, etc., and playing with my two cats. I started to think about what, if any, difference there was between the pig that provided the bacon on my plate, the cow that provided some steak last night, and my cats. Do we just eat the ugly animals? That sounds a lot like the justification used by the Nazis to kill Jews. They're different, so we can kill them. So Dale Littlejohn writes, I started cutting down my meat consumption then and there and retooled my cooking skills to the veggie side of things. It was a gradual process of eliminating meat at home, then over several years, not eating meat at family dinners or business functions. I haven't gone vegan yet, but I know that is the direction that I'm headed for. So, that is Animal Voices. We're right out of time. It goes so quickly when you're having fun. And thank you for listening. Our webpage is animalvoices.org. Thank you.